Hello and welcome to Zed Forward, a podcast celebrating authors and other individuals who are involved with projects for the benefit of Seton Hall University and the world around us. My name is Alan DeLosier, and I'm proud to introduce our guest for today, Dr. Dermot Quinn. Dr. Quinn is a professor and director of graduate studies within the Department of History here at Seton Hall University. His research interests include Catholic history, Irish American history, and the history of Seton Hall University, as we'll learn more in a few moments. Dr. Quinn was educated at Trinity College Dublin, where he earned his BA degree, and he later took advanced studies at the University of Oxford, where he earned his PhD. Other scholarship that Dr. Quinn has produced include The Irish in New Jersey, Four Centuries of American Life, Patronage and Piety, The Politics of English Roman Catholicism, and Understanding Northern Ireland. Now, it's my pleasure to talk to Dr. Quinn about his latest book, The History of Seton Hall University from 1856 to 2006. Welcome to our show, Dr. Quinn. And I think the first question I have is, what inspired you to write this particular book on our institution?
Well, Alan, thank you very much for inviting me, and it's wonderful to be part of this podcast series. I know that the earlier podcasts have been well received and are really very, very good, so I'm delighted to be part of this ongoing conversation. Well, the answer to your question, the very simple answer to your question, is that I was invited to write this book by Monsignor Robert Sheeran. And there's a bit of a kind of a back history here. Monsignor Sheeran, as you know, was president of Seton Hall during the late 1990s and early 2000s. And the idea was that we would have a sesquicentennial history, to commemorate, 150 years of Seton Hall's history. So Monsignor asked me to prepare a book, for that sesquicentennial, and made a wonderful conversation, and he was very, very supportive. I said to him, and he happily agreed, that it's the kind of book that needs to be done at a fairly serious scholarly level. I mean, it isn't supposed to be just a kind of easy sort of coffee table book. Not that there's anything wrong with a coffee table book, of course, but I mean, the ambitions were slightly higher than that. So I said to Monsignor that I would be more than happy and indeed honoured to write the book, but that I would have to do it, as a kind of fairly objective piece of scholarship, as I put it to him, kind of warts and all, to use that famous phrase of Oliver Cromwell. And Monsignor, of course, agreed to that. So that was a few years before the sesquicentennial, which obviously fell on 2006. And as your astute readers will notice, the book didn't come out in 2006 or 2007 or even 2010. It took quite a while to put this book together. The moral of that story, by the way, is that once you miss a deadline, you've certainly missed a deadline, and all of the pressure seems to disappear, which is not a good thing, because you don't want to have a sort of open-ended, meandering sort of research project. So to answer your question, Alan, I was asked to write the book, and I obviously agreed to write the book. And I did it with the understanding that it should be a fairly serious piece of kind of historical scholarship. And that I hope I've done that.
Great. Sounds good, Dr. Quinn. Now, what are some of the best resources in terms of formats and individual items that you found in terms of putting this particular work together in the course of your research journey?
Well, here I pay, I hope, a very heartfelt a vote of thanks to yourself and to the library and to the archives at Seton Hall. I mean, Alan, as you well know, maybe painfully, I mean, you were part of this project from the very beginning, what we have at Seton Hall is an absolutely extraordinary archive. In fact, two archives, or several archives, but the two archives that were of particular importance to me were the archives of the university, which are extensive and expansive, and to the best of my knowledge, pretty complete. You know, I mean, there are things that aren't there, but of course, you don't know what isn't there because you don't see what isn't there. But they are pretty extensive archives. And the second important source are the archives of the Archdiocese of Newark, because of course Seton Hall is the Archdiocesan or the Diocesan University. So those constituted the most important sources, and you and your archival colleagues, Kate Dodds and Tony Lee and Howard McGinn and so on, were just enormously helpful to me in putting this story together. I mean, it's a fairly daunting thing because, as you know, and maybe most of your listeners won't know, behind the those imposing doors of the vault, there are shelf after shelf after shelf of boxes going back not simply to 1856, but a good deal earlier than that. And to write this book, I pretty much have to read all of that. The reality is that, and this is the secret that historians know and maybe the general public doesn't know, that a lot of it isn't all that interesting. I mean, a lot of it is just stuff is collected. It was of fairly modest interest at the time, and it is of kind of even more modest interest now. But in order to do the thing properly, you have to read everything. So in a way, what the historian does is to filter out all the boring stuff, so that the reader can get maybe the less boring stuff. And I didn't mind that because, all is grist, everything has interest, the reality is that as you go through box after box, I mean, some of it you can read fairly quickly. It's pretty clear that there's not much here that is of great value. And some of it you have to read slowly. You could be going through a box of material and discover some absolutely extraordinary item, a letter that tells you what you were looking for and you hadn't expected to see it, or you could find just a whole run of materials which is very, very interesting. As I say, behind those rather imposing doors of the vault, you've got hundreds of boxes, maybe thousands of boxes. I don't know. Certainly thousands of discrete items, and you have to read all of them. And I kind of enjoyed that because you lose yourself in the project. You find leads that you want to explore, and that's what I did. Now, your question was, what sources? And those are the major sources, obviously. But of course, there are all sorts of secondary materials. I mean, you have to read kind of the history of New Jersey. You have to read the history of Catholic higher education. You read the history of American Catholicism. So it's this combination of primary materials, mainly housed in our archives, and then secondary material. So that's broadly how I went about the project.
Sounds good, Dermot. And thank you so much for the plug. But as you know, it takes a village, the ones who produced, the ones who offer, and yourself who put it all together. Now, in terms of more specifics, you say, there's a lot of materials that may not fit into your book, but what are some of the individual items that you found that were really inspiring or interesting or just even quite, amazing in terms of what you discovered and what you put in your book?
Well, I mean, that's such an interesting question. People who read this book, if they do read it, might find things that they find particularly fascinating. I don't want to say that they shouldn't find it fascinating, but things that sort of really appeals to me. All of it was of I think really significant interest, but I found some of the earlier materials particularly engaging, kind of descriptions of sort of student life in say the 1870s. And when I say descriptions, I mean sort of letters Father Michael Corrigan, who subsequently, as you know, became Bishop of Newark and then Archbishop of New York, letters that he wrote, to parents or parents' letters to him. And that kind of reveals the kind of the hidden world of Seton Hall, say, in the 1870s. And I just came across those kind of almost by accident, actually, in the archives. They weren't at that point all that well catalogued. I mean, they were essentially basically in a box, and they hadn't at that stage been catalogued. And I kind of found these a kind of a treasure trove. So that was particularly engaging. You know, there are all sorts of later materials that I found particularly fascinating. But I suppose the early history of Seton Hall, which is relatively unknown, or at any rate, it's known, but in a fairly general way, I found that, you know, kind of especially fascinating.
Sounds good, Dermot. And also, you know, in terms of outside the archives too, I know you have a large support system on campus. Who are some of the individuals you've talked to, you know, during the course of your preparation for this work? And what are some of the wonderful takeaways from this experience?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, Alan, that it does take a village, and Seton Hall, I think, in all sorts of ways, is a village, for good or maybe ill, but it certainly has that kind of intimacy of a village. Well, a couple of people I have to single out. First of all, yourself and your colleagues, who were you know, particularly helpful, and you know, I mean, please don't hide your light under a bushel. I mean, what you know about Seton Hall is really very considerable, particularly, of course, its sporting life, and I'm very, very grateful for that. I was very, very grateful, and I'm very grateful for the help of our late colleague Monsignor Francis Seymour. And Monsignor Seymour had a kind of extraordinary knowledge of particularly the priestly life of Seton Hall and of the Archdiocese of Newark, and a great, his memory, I think, was kind of photographic for the priestly life of Seton Hall. Before him, of course, our colleague Monsignor Bill Field, who is sadly deceased, as indeed is Monsignor Seymour, and Monsignor Field kind of connects us to really almost the middle years of Seton Hall, because Monsignor Field was around for a very long time as a student. And he was able to give me some of the almost the folk memory, if you will, of Seton Hall. I would like to kind of single out my colleagues in the history department, who were very supportive, very helpful, and I think helpful in all sorts of ways. I mean, one obvious way is simply to encourage, you know, to say keep on going. You'll get there eventually, that's important. But maybe more specifically, important in helping me shape some of the questions that I should be asking. They would ask questions which hadn't occurred to me, and I would say, "Yep, of course, that's such an important question." People like yourself, people like Monsignor Seymour, people like Monsignor Field, my colleagues in the history department, and then I should single out, some of my pals, like Dr. Jim McGlone, who's been at Seton Hall for quite some time, now happily retired. But Jim has a sort of deep sort of a personal connection to Seton Hall. He knew a lot of the people that I came to write about. So some of the older folk, you might say, who had this sort of memory of the Seton Hall that I didn't know. Obviously I came to Seton Hall in 1990, so everything up until that point was terra incognita. So they were very helpful as well. So those are some of the people who helped.
Sounds good, Dermot. And thanks for this is what I was hoping you would mention your colleagues in history, Dr. McGlone and so forth. The good part is, along with them, and also those who are reading your book, what are some of the reactions you've had so far? And I know there's more to come as the future draws forward, in terms of the response to the book.
Well, people have been on the whole very, very generous about it. People have said nice things about it, and that's very gratifying, of course. Not everybody will will read it in the same way. Certainly there will be people who will read it who say, well, I don't remember it like that, or that doesn't seem to me to be quite right. And indeed, obviously, some people have generously pointed out a couple of little factual mistakes in it, which happens, of course. But on the whole, people have been generous, and indeed in some cases very generous. Some people have maybe a slightly different take on some aspects of the story. As Queen Elizabeth said a couple of years ago, recollections may vary, and that's perfectly reasonable, because of course this is simply my view of what happened, and I think it's a pretty well informed view, because I have immersed myself obviously in the archives. But people who were there, have obviously a kind of knowledge that I couldn't possibly have, you have to sort of defer to that, or recognize that, or acknowledge that. You were there and I wasn't, and what you say demands respect. But to answer your question, Alan, people have been kind of generous and well disposed to it, and that's very gratifying, because it is, frankly, it took a long time to do, and it was fairly hard work, so it's nice that people find some merit in it. And by the way, I should once again, I know that you're embarrassed by this sort of Niagara of praise here, but I should thank you for having read it in manuscript, pointing out some things that might be done otherwise. And I forgot to mention, and I now make good on that mistake, Monsignor Robert Wister, who really was extremely helpful. I don't know why I forgot to mention Monsignor Wister, because Monsignor, as you know, wrote a really wonderful history of Immaculate Conception Seminary. For many years, Monsignor and I would clock in together in the archives, as you know, and he would swap bits of information with me, he was extremely helpful in putting this book together. But thank you again for reading it manuscript.
Thank you so much, Dorian. And actually, I didn't ask to interview Dr. Quinn for these very kind and unnecessary but grateful words. But the reason is because, knowing Dr. Quinn's work and just wide scope, this is really important. And also, this is good to know about the reception, the positives. And of course, you'll have a few who are, have their own recollections, as you say. The respect factor goes very deep, as I did for you, Dorian. And speaking of respect, in terms of the book's usage, especially in terms of an academic context, how would you show your scholarship to students of today, not only in terms of the history of Seton Hall, but in terms of your historiography of Catholic higher education and other aspects of this book that have that speak to historians from all quarters of the globe?
Well, I suppose what you're asking is, how would this book be received in the historical profession generally? I think the answer to that, again, I hope it's well received. I think it has been quite well received, but it has to be understood, Alan, and I think I make this point fairly obvious in the book, that this isn't a history simply of Seton Hall. If it were, it would, I think, be interesting. But the interest of Seton Hall is the way in which Seton Hall tells many stories, and it tells many stories about many things. So, as I said in a little talk when we launched this book, if you want to know about the history of New Jersey, read this book. If you want to know the history of American Catholic higher education, read this book. If you want to know the history of class relations, social class relations. I'm not talking about academic classes, but social class relations. You should read this book. If you want to know about women in New Jersey, read this book. If you want to know the story of American immigration history, read this book, because all of those things are sort of bound up in the Seton Hall story. So I hope that when historians get their hands on this book, if they do, they will read it not simply as the story of, we built this building and then we built that building and then we had another president, but that all of that story. Brings together lots of hidden stories, and I hope reveals them, and that's really that was the ambition of the book. And I think if you read it attentively, you can see all of those other stories played out.
That sounds good there, and it's true. It's you really put it together in terms of context and building forward. So that's good to know. And I know it's still early in terms of the release of the book. So I think more momentum will carry on in terms of the semesters ahead. So in terms of your own students and your own teaching at this point, what's some of the advice you want to you could give to them, along with what you just mentioned about books that capture place, time, individuals beyond the institution proper? What are some of the things you tell the future historians of America and the world from your own viewpoint?
Well, I suppose. I first of all encourage them to read as much history as possible. History is, it's the most liberating of the liberal arts, I think. As Chesterton said on another occasion, speaking about the Catholic Church, he said, I give thanks that it released me from the indignity of being a child of my own time. As you read history, you are able to, so to speak, escape from the fairly narrow prison of being a child of your own time. So I think that I would encourage, that's one thing that I encourage students to do. I certainly encourage them to immerse themselves in primary documents, and to encourage them, in other words, to realize that history is, in some very basic and simple way, a constructed thing. I mean, it's a thing that is constructed by the historian from various materials, archival and otherwise. You can't really construct history without getting your fingers dirty in the dusty archives. I think that's in some ways kind of rather obvious and banal, but I certainly encourage them to do that. I encourage them to realize that history is, as an intellectual discipline, well, first of all, is a discipline. I mean, there are certain protocols that you have to abide by. I mean, you can't just sort of jump into the archives and say, oh, here we are, let's just swim around here and see what happens. There are certain disciplinary procedures that you have to be aware of. I mean, who is writing this document? Why is this document being written? Who is the audience? What is the audience for this document? I mean, all of these kind of basic things that are kind of second nature to professional historians, but you have to encourage students to think about. So there are it's an intellectual discipline, obviously. So you, by asking the right question, you'll get decent answers. If you ask foolish questions, you'll get foolish answers. But as well as that, it's ultimately an act of imagination. I mean, we have to sort of speak, imagine ourselves in these worlds. I think that, frankly, if you don't have much in the way of imagination, you're not going to be much of an historian. I think you really do have to engage in this kind of imaginative placing yourself in the lives of people that you've never met and will never meet and can never meet, that's what I would encourage students to do as well. So I encourage them to read a lot of history. I encourage them to obviously use a lot of primary materials. I encourage them to ask good questions, and then I encourage them to. But I suppose when I say to use their imaginations, I'm really inviting them to enjoy this. I think that It ought to be enjoyable. And certainly when I wrote this book, I kind of enjoyed it enormously. I hope readers kind of enjoy it. But I just enjoyed the detective work of history. I think that's the kind of hook that you use to get students to be engaged in it. So those are kind of my broad responses to that question.
Yeah. Well said, Dr. Quinn. It's true. Looking at the next generation. But let me ask you, for the current and the future planning of your own publishing career, do you have any other publications in the works, either book projects, periodicals, or other items? Oh, and I forgot to mention at the top of the introduction, Dr. Quinn is director of the G.K. Chesterton Institute right here at Seton Hall University, so he is very well-rounded and all types of scholarships. So I'm just curious, are you working on anything now? And we're looking forward to hopefully reading more of your work in the near future.
Well, I think one very, very trivial correction, Alan. I'm not the director of the Chesterton Institute. That's my colleague, Gloria Grabois. But I am the editor of the Chesterton Review. That is an important part of my portfolio, you might say. I do write quite a bit about Chesterton and talk a fair bit about Chesterton. And I'm interested in a kind of a longer term book on Chesterton. Now, it may not happen, but I'm certainly hoping to write a book on Chesterton. And in particular, to gather together some of the things that I've written about Chesterton already and kind of edit those into a more extended monograph. And I'm kind of interested in, I suppose, what you might call the reception of Chesterton, how Chesterton was understood or how Chesterton was received over quite a long life of literary production. And I think the argument that I would try to explore in this book is that Chesterton, for those of you, for listeners who are maybe not familiar with Chesterton, Chesterton was a really important English writer. He was born in 1874 and he died in 1936. He converted to Catholicism in 1922. So he is often regarded as a great apologist for Catholicism. But, you know, he had a long, so to speak, pre-Catholic life. So he was a journalist. He was a philosopher. He was a playwright, a novelist, probably best known for his Father Brown stories, these wonderful detective stories. And Chesterton, I think, was not simply remarkably versatile as a writer, but a remarkably deep writer. It sounds, as I describe him, that he was a fairly that it might have been a sort of a popular writer, and he certainly was a popular writer. But I think as well as that, he was a really deep thinker. I think some of the depth of that thought, is certainly worth exploring. So I'm interested in how Chesterton was received, how people understood him, how people made sense of him, how he was received across the world, because he wasn't simply an English writer. He wasn't simply popular in England. He was popular all over the world. He was popular in Poland, in South America, and in all sorts of non-Anglophone places. So the book that I'm working on, which may take as long as the Seton Hall history, which is not a great thought. That's kind of my current project.
Wonderful. Thanks, Dermot. And my apologies to Gloria, who's a wonderful person too. Yeah, yeah. And your good work with the Chesterton Review is always welcome in terms of reading that at various intervals during the year. In terms of the interviewer's question log, historically and traditionally, what's one question I didn't ask you that you'd like to answer? This gives you the opportunity to express something that's not in the.
Yeah, I was expecting you to ask, what's your fee for this broadcast? And I Well, I'm not you. You kind of put me on the spot there. I thought you might have asked me about some of the particular characters of Seton Hall's history, and was there any character in particular who jumped out? I suppose I could answer that in this way: that one of the organizational principles of this history, it's very difficult, first of all, to get this mass of material and just sort of hope that it forms itself into some coherent story. So I thought that probably the easiest way to do it, easiest for me and maybe easiest for the reader, is simply to divide it up in terms of kind of presidential terms of office. So we have Bishop Bailey, we've got Father McQuaid, we've got Father Corrigan, and so on. So that's roughly the way in which I've organized this material. And, you know, that being the case, I was kind of struck by some presidents. I'm struck by many of them. And I would maybe make two points. One a kind of anecdotal point, and the other a more sort of conceptual point. And the first is that, I mean, there are lots of interesting characters. Say Monsignor McLaughlin, who was president in the 1920s and 30s, is a kind of a fascinating and eccentric figure. I mean, a kind of seriously eccentric figure. Almost maybe slightly mad, so I found him very, very interesting. And then there are other characters or other presidents whom I found engaging and attractive as people. Father Fahey, for example, who was president in the 1970s. By all accounts, was a really remarkable and really lovely man, I was engaged by him, and then there were other presidents who struck me as maybe not all that interesting or not all that significant. I mean, some of them are insignificant in the sense that they didn't serve for very long. You know, I mean, the second president of Seton Hall is a man called Father Daniel Fisher, about whom very little is known, actually. So, I mean, he doesn't exactly make the seismograph, jump. So you might have asked me a little about some of these kind of interesting presidents. And then I said that, you could see these people just in terms of anecdotes and human interest stories. But I suppose a kind of more conceptual question might be this. When you look at the history of Seton Hall, when you look at the history of anything, kind of one of the basic questions that you have to ask is about what I suppose historians call slightly pompously agency. That is to say, did people make a difference? I think that that's a question that is important to ask and hard to answer. And when you look at some of these presidents, you could ask, did they make a difference? Which is another way of asking the question, would this story have been the same had they not been around? When you look at Seton Hall, you can see that Seton Hall, and this comes back to the point that I was making a few minutes ago about Seton Hall being part of many, many stories, and many stories being part of Seton Hall. So it's a migration story, it's a Catholic story, it's a sociological story, and so on. So that kind of poses a question for us, and that is, well, maybe these big trends of which Seton Hall is part and which Seton Hall helps to exemplify, maybe these things would have happened regardless of the particular president. So that, for example, you look at Seton Hall in the 1960s, and Seton Hall underwent an enormous kind of institutional revolution. It got bigger, it got more professional, it got more I suppose, international, you might say. And it certainly reflected a lot of the turmoil of the 1960s, turmoil in American society, turmoil in the church, and so on. So those are big trends that Seton Hall could not avoid being part of. And the question then becomes, well, I mean, was it significant that Bishop Doherty was the president as opposed to someone else? And that is what you might call a counterfactual question. It's a what-if question. That's the other kind of question that you should ask when you tell Seton Hall as a history of individual presidents. Because I mean, there are some presidents who seem to be very, very significant in Seton Hall's history. Monsignor Kelly, for example, at the before the Second World War and after the Second World War. And Seton Hall, of course, was transformed after 1945. But it seems to me that in some rather significant ways, it would have been transformed anyway, regardless of the person who was in charge. That isn't to say that the person who was in charge wasn't important. The person who was in charge gave a particular direction to the transformation. But I think the social trends outside of Seton Hall were so substantial and so powerful that it wouldn't have that kind of human agency is kind of a little diminished by that, you know. So that's the question that you might have asked me, Alan. I don't fault you for not asking me it, but that's that might be one possible way of thinking about the history.
Great. That was my secret plan there in terms of having you, because you're more of an expert. I'm more of a neophyte in the interviewing. So I'm glad you brought that up. And the wonderful part about not only what Dr. Quinn mentioned is that when you get into the book, you'll meet a lot of individual characters along with the bigger story. Now, in terms of finding the book, we have it on sale in our university bookstore. You could find it, shameless plug for the book, at our university libraries. And Dermot, where else can people find this particular volume? And
Well, that's a good question. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not quite sure. I am sure that they can find it on Amazon. It's certainly available on Amazon. I haven't, to be perfectly honest, been in a bookstore since it came out, which is maybe terrible, but I'm not sure whether it's available in local bookstores. I suspect maybe not. It might be slightly too specific for sort of Barnes and Noble or places like that. But you never know. But it's certainly available on Amazon, and I think that's where most people that I know who have bought it have, in fact, bought it on Amazon.
Sounds good, Dermot. And this is how we're going to pay your salary, by these corporate plugs. So it's all good.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so we're at the end of our interview for now, but we're hoping to have you back at another time. Any parting words and inspiration for anybody who reads the book and those who you encounter in terms of class and colleagues in the future?
Well, you know, I think, Alan, some of my students have bought it, and I'm gratified by that. And I simply say to them, if they ask me to sign it, that they are now part of this story. It's a long and splendid story in many ways. I mean, it's not, as I said at the start, it's not completely unblemished. I mean, there are warts as well as there are some darker episodes. I want students, and maybe everybody who's at Seton Hall, to realize that they are, you know, part of a bigger story. As I said a few minutes ago, the job of the historian is to engage in engage his or her imagination, and that's what I do, I think, when I walk around Seton Hall. I think of that little scene, remember, in the movie The Sixth Sense, you know, that Bruce Willis movie, where the The child of the boy says, you know, I can see dead people. When I walk around Seton Hall, I can see dead people. That's what I want people to realize, is they are now part of the story, that people came before them, people walked through these corridors, people walked through this chapel, people walked through what we now call President's Hall. They were as solid and as fleshy as we are, and they had important lives to live. So I want people to realize that they have now entered into this story. At some point they will exit this story. I have a kind of Burkean sense of the continuity of history, and that we're all part of a great kind of stream, or indeed you might say a great melody. That's what I encourage students to think. I suppose also to encourage them to be grateful for the work that people did before them. We take a lot for granted. We take, in a way, far too much for granted. Seton Hall was made by people who weren't asking for gratitude or reward or much in the way of recognition. It was made by people whose lives are, for the most part, hidden. I hope revealed some of those hidden lives, but a lot of those hidden lives are still hidden, and they're hidden to me, people that I've never met, people whom I don't even write about in the book. These are the people who helped students. These are the people who patiently graded papers. These are the people who heroically came to work on wet mornings and so on. I think we should acknowledge that and be grateful for that. That's what I kind of encourage. That's what I might want to encourage students and all of us to think about whenever they read the book.
Great. Thanks, Dermot. Well said. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing your time, your wisdom, and your inspiration and generosity with us today and through your book. Another commercial message. Dr. Quinn's book, Dr. Dermot Quinn, is Seton Hall University, 1856 to 2006, published by Rutgers University Press, New Brunswick, in this year, 2023. So thanks again to Dr. Quinn for joining us, and thanks to you for listening to Zed Forward. Please join us next time when we talk to another person from the Seton Hall community about their work and how it benefits the world around us. Until we meet again, all the best. Thank you very much.